Welcome to the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, Executive Director of Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Support for the Archive Project comes from Cole Haan, the fashion brand that's acknowledging extraordinary people who write, read, and shape the world through their extraordinary stories. All this and more at colehaan.com. In this episode, we feature novelists Lauren Groff and Rachel Kushner from an event moderated by John Freeman that took place at the Portland Book Festival on November 10th, 2018. Groff and Kushner are two of the most accomplished and exciting American novelists at work today. At this event, they discussed their most recent books, Florida by Groff and The Mars Room by Kushner. And though these two writers differ in many ways, they also share many of the same concerns, particularly around power and control and the implications for women. Their books examine this theme time and again in situations as varied as marriage, the criminal justice system, and through the lens of childhood, to name just a few. The conversation begins with a discussion of geography and how it has shaped the storytelling of these writers in significant ways. Here's our moderator, John Freeman.
We're going to have a conversation for about an hour, and in the middle, Rachel and Lauren will read, at the end of which you'll ask some questions, and outside there will be books which can be bought, and you can get them signed. But I'm going to jump right in with questions now. Lauren and Rachel, you both moved from one place to another at a kind of significant stage of your life. Rachel, you moved from Oregon to California when you were about 11. Lauren, you moved to Florida relatively recently, which you can see in this book. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about how these landscapes affected your imagination as writers, and with that, how they changed, if at all, what you thought was dangerous.
Wow. No, it's a great question. I don't know, I am from Eugene, Oregon. And hey, Eugene. Eugene was an incredibly sweet place to be a child. There was no anxiety about poverty there. I mean, there was some, but not the way there is now for marginalized, vulnerable people. No one had money in Eugene. It was students and loggers. And students lived, you know, we lived in a bus. Other students lived in student housing. Then we had a house, but it was, you know, $90 a month. I had a paper route. I delivered the Eugene Register Guard. It was a very free, open world in a small place that didn't really have many dangers. And then I moved to San Francisco at the age of 10. It's odd to talk biographically, but in a way, I guess you probably insightfully gathered that the book has something to do with that shift, which was in a way a trauma, but an excitement in the way that, you know, everything dark that you symbolize in your life, I think, produces some kind of energy that can be used later for fiction. I moved to a big city. I went to giant public schools. I was had my ass kicked on the first day of school. And that was normal. It was a school that was very violent. Kids fought every day. There were levels of race humiliation there, like nothing I had experienced in my life previously had prepared me to understand. I still don't entirely understand. But, you know, it was a city, and it was a time, also the 1980s, when kids weren't really supervised by their parents, at least not in the world I grew up in. So part of it was just seeing physical violence between people, which I think makes a huge impact on kids. At least it did for me. The first time I saw two boys fighting at school, and I'm sorry to be to give the gory details, but the amount of blood that was left from this fight, I was in sixth grade, I was 11 years old, it shocked me, I think. And some of writing a book that partially takes place in the memories of a woman who's from my neighborhood in San Francisco was an opportunity to try to reckon with some of that material.
Yeah, let me interject here. Romy, one of the main characters of Rachel's book, The Mars Room, serving a double life sentence. And the book travels in several tracks, one of which is her going into prison, and you follow her through prison. The other is going back in time to her upbringing in San Francisco in the early 80s, which is why I asked about this. And Lauren, your stories are all set, well, not all of them, but most of them are set in Florida. There's one in Salvador, and they go a little bit elsewhere. But how did moving to Florida, you come from Cooperstown, that obviously influenced Monsters of Templeton and some of the stories in your first book. What changed for you in your imagination and what you thought was dangerous upon discovering Florida personally?
Mm-hmm. How many Floridians are in the room? Yeah. I say this wherever I go, and there's always one. There was one in Edinburgh, at least, because people feel this ferocious adoration / hatred for Florida. In recent events, I agree. So I am from the Northeast, and I believe that landscape has a profound effect upon character. I think that the temperature, the geography that we look out and see on a daily basis does something to the soul. So growing up in this tiny little town, 1,900 people, famous for obviously the Baseball Hall of Fame and the opera, having a huge number of tourists come, and yet my parents sort of let us just be feral in a lot of ways. I swam all day in the lake that was just really beautiful and wonderful. So I had this idyllic childhood. I lived in France, I lived in Amherst, Massachusetts, I lived in California, I lived in Wisconsin and Kentucky, and finally I moved to Florida 12 years ago because my husband took over a family business, and as soon as that happens, you can never leave again. And I felt trapped, and I am trapped. I'm emotionally trapped in this place that I didn't want to be in, this place that's incredibly humid, that's very hot, that's full of really disgusting bugs and alligators. I mean, my parents in-law have lost 3 dogs because they live on a pond where there are alligators. So it's this place where at first I was actually afraid to go outside. I was afraid. I was just afraid of it. I was afraid of loving it. I was afraid of getting comfortable there because it didn't correspond to who I thought I was. And for 5 years, I resisted it and hated it. And then slowly, reluctantly, it grew on me like a mold. So now I feel Floridian, and it would take 2 hours to unpack what that means, but I do. I feel like a Floridian.
You mentioned a word that comes up in both of your books, which is feral. In a number of your stories, there are children, usually boys, and the narrator often looks at these kind of wonderful feral boys, and she's protective of them in that state, and yet similarly, the narrators are often themselves feeling a bit feral, but feeling like they need to control that. And Rachel, since your book takes place in the criminal justice system, if you can call it that, which is a system of control and punishment, there's a lot of directives about how to behave, which you can run through perhaps in the answer to this question I'm about to ask, which is, at what stage is your book asking questions about who has the right to be controlled? And what gets controlled? Because I think in both cases, the people being controlled in your books are women.
That's interesting. I can see that as a very valid question. I would need to think about the answer, but maybe I could partly answer it by saying I come at that from a slightly different angle, which is to say, I don't so much think about who has the right to be controlled as much as I try to ruminate into my own feelings about institutional logic and what it is and how foreign it feels and what it does to people. There's a great book by the famous American sociologist Irving Goffman called Asylums. Do you know this book? And he talks about the cultures, not just of prisons, but hospitals and ships and psychiatric wards as all having similar ways of stripping people of their identities and forcing them into modalities of behavior that are distinctly institutional by framework. And I've always felt that. I've always chafed at that. And I've spent a lot of time in prisons in California, so I'm familiar with the way that women and men, I should say, are controlled. And in writing the book, I was interested in some sort of links between the inside of prisons and the outside of prisons, and the parts of that institutional logic that are more invisible, or at least I should say particularly invisible to middle class people. So that was kind of the angle.
One of the things that she points out in the book, which is wonderfully discursive and full of anecdotes, but also facts that you will not know unless you read this book. For example, the prisoners who are working for 22 cents an hour, say in the shop class in the prison, are building podiums for courtrooms.
That's absolutely true, actually. And it was me who discovered that on my own tour. I went on a kind of a major tour of mostly California men's prisons with criminology students who were planning on getting jobs in corrections, because California Department of Corrections is always hiring. And I went kind of as a continuing education student, quote, unquote. And now I've gotten in big trouble for talking about this publicly, and the California Department of Corrections has banned me from their prisons, so I don't give a f- if I talk about it anymore. But I didn't mean to make you guys clap or anything, but then I always feel silly. I was taken into many of the prison industry association's projects. The different prisons, they're quite proud to show you what they're doing. And one of the first places that I went was into a textiles workshop, they were calling it, and they're making prison uniforms for that prison and also for other prisons. And it was just such an interesting moment. The guy who was running it had had a family surfwear company, but they had lost their business when much of that kind of textile stuff was taken overseas to places like Bangladesh, you know, literally the poorest country in the world. So how can you compete with the poorest country in the world in terms of wages you can pay? And see, here he was working in the prison. And I noticed that they weren't sewing fabric. They were just gluing it. And he said, oh, they learn all this stuff about textiles, and it trains them so that when upon their release, they can seek good jobs. And I said, well, what kinds of things are they learning in here? And he said, well, really, this isn't about the actual skills you acquire. It's about learning to work, which was just an amazing moment for me. And down the hall from there, they were making goggles for prison industry. So the safety goggles that they wear for prison industries, that was one of the prison industries. And down the hall from that, they were making boots for prison industry. So it's this bizarre tautology where the prison is basically making itself all the time. It's not about profit. Prisons cost the state of California an enormous amount of money, and they're mostly public. I know people are freaked out about private prisons, but that's a tiny percentage of people in prisons and money that flows to prisons. So it's a public thing, and what the prison is spending money on with their infrastructure and these jobs is the incapacitation. So it's like a factory where the prisons make their own incapacitation, if you can handle that conceptually.
No, it's mind-boggling. Lauren, we started this by sort of talking about control and what is and who is feral, but I want to come back to you with a sort of elaboration on what she just said, because these two books are very different. Lauren's is a collection of short stories, and Rachel's is a novel. They have different styles, but they demonstrate the capacity for fiction to deal with very broad and urgent problems, prison-industrial complex, climate change to some degree, but through very intimate ways. And Lauren, this is your fifth book, and like Fates and Furies, this is kind of touches gently on the pressure points of marriage. And you know, as Rachel was speaking about something that creates its incapacity, you know, in some ways you can look at marriage as a vertically integrated control system. And I wonder...
That's so romantic.
I just realized we're both married to Floridians.
Oh, God.
Sorry, don't mean to change the subject.
That explains everything. I know.
But in Fates and Furies and in Acadia and in other work of yours, you are kind of ruminating quite a bit on the way that marriage is a contradictory closed system that contains both positive and negative pressures. And I wonder if you can talk about how that operates in this new book, in which you're also thinking a lot about the imbalance of an environmental system, which is tipping out of control.
Mm. Yeah, so I would have tweaked your original question, which I thought was really brilliant, to expand maybe into the idea of domesticity and not just marriage, not just this feeling of being in control, but the feeling of what domesticity is and understanding what it means to be a domestic person while also longing to be the opposite. What does wildness mean? And how can one live in a place like Florida, which is so liminal in a lot of ways, and you pass from one state to the other without necessarily understanding where you are. And in fact, a lot of times when I'm inside the house, so is nature, right? And I'm a writer, so all I do is sit in the house all day long. So my feeling is these tensions are in all of my stories and all of my books, almost like the tension on the surface of a soap bubble. This is how I see it. It's a constant pushing outward against an oppositional force against these constraints and these dictates that are imposed somewhat invisibly upon my characters. And within marriage or within a partnership, a long-term partnership, there are these invisible constraints that sort of push in, particularly on the women, let's be honest, in the way that the outside world sort of perceives the intimate relationship, but also the way that it develops within this sort of utopian community of two. So what I'm really, really interested in is in that really thin, very, very fine, almost molecular level of opposition between the air and the internal force. And that's what I feel like each of these stories tries to do. It tries to sort of identify what that bubble is and tend to see how far you can push it before it pops.
And it puts a ton of pressure on the actual prose, which is very beautiful. And throughout the book, she's constantly making reference to, not in an annoying way, poetry.
Because maybe annoying. I don't know.
No, not at all. Because you have the sonar of characters who are listening for the bubble pop, and because of that, there's a lot of outward looking moments for the characters who are looking at a landscape which is full of alligators and dangerous lizards and snakes and seagulls and and they're writing about these I wonder if you can talk a little bit about writing about the natural world so that it doesn't only symbolize and then maybe you could read from one of the stories.
Sure.
Because I think what this book does, among other things so beautifully, is it captures the strangeness of the natural world, because it just is. And we can come at it with all sorts of projections, like a marriage or a person or a friend, but it still will just remain in its own state, hopefully for longer than we are currently trying to make it stay as. But I wonder if you can talk about what that means when you're in a place and you're writing about its ecology.
Well, so I think my feeling for the natural world comes out of my daily runs. And there's in Gainesville, where I live, which is in the middle of the swamp, there's actually this giant prairie, and it's full of wild bison and wild horses that are the descendants of the conquistadors. It's a really amazing place, coral snakes and all sorts of poisonous and dangerous things. But I run there miles and miles every morning as the sun's coming up. And it does multiple things for me. One, it reminds me to get out of my head, right, and to actually live in the world. And two, it reminds me that we're all animals, even if we believe that we are somehow distinct or separate from or above animals. We are animals. And understanding this and sort of seeing the way over the past 12 years, and actually on a very granular way, you can see the way that climate change is actually changing the prairie, and it breaks your mother-loving heart on a day-to-day basis. You can sort of feel like an animal, feel like a human, understand the way that we live within this much larger web than we are able to comprehend, and to see the way that we are affecting that web, and the way that we pretend that we don't have to be the voices of the voiceless, but it's our job as humans to stand up for nature, I believe. And so that it's filled my work for the past 12 years with this sense of injustice and sense of the profound immorality in this feeling that humanity is somehow above nature. I think that's a profoundly immoral act or an immoral stance. Yeah.
Do you think you could? Do you think you could read for us?
Oh, sure. So you talked about the seagulls. So I'm going to read a little bit about seagulls. So this is from the final story in the collection. It's called Ypres. It's about this little tiny town in Normandy where this mother takes her two little boys. It's not autofiction, and she's a mess. And here she is, okay. She is drinking champagne out of the bottle. It tastes better that way, bubblier and colder. And after a week here, she wants the cold all the way inside her to the center of her bones. Down at the little cluster of tin shacks beside the boardwalk, a band is playing not bad cover versions of The Eagles, Led Zeppelin, and Pink Floyd, though the singer's accent makes the words go rubbery and bounce. The sunset is so excessive it fills her with nostalgia. A hot burn, everything shot red, even the skins of the slate roof tiles. The color feels like youth. One by one, the seagulls line up on the opposite peak. The giant seagull flaps to a stop on the chimney and basks there in the light. They're just birds, she tells herself. In the long row of gulls, there's a mangy tiny one at the center. It struggles its shoulders against its neighbors, too skinny to be at ease like the rest of the birds. They've gone quiet again, and she doesn't know what she's watching at first when the seagull to the left of the mangy one seems to bow its head at the shivering thing. And then the one to the right does, bowing and bowing over and over again with their heads. Perhaps the little one is some kind of prince bird. Perhaps they're paying their respects, she thinks, confused, and then the other seagulls nearby move in on the bowing, and only then does she understand that they aren't bowing, they are killing the skinny, tiny gull, pecking it to death. Surely, if she hurls the bottle at them, they'd stop. But she is frozen, and the murder is over so quickly, a heap of bloody feathers that slides out of view. It has all been done in silence, though a high buzzing has risen to her ears from inside. The little seagull hadn't even screamed. It accepted meekly. It seemed to have offered itself to the others. Surely, it had a right at least to a scream. Even if it couldn't avoid the outcome, it had the luxury of protest. I'm going to stop there.
Lauren mentioned the idea of being above humans being above nature, and that idea I think is defined as dominion, which comes in some part from the Bible. Mm. And both of you, since we're in a church,
let's Genesis, right?
It's in Genesis, and it's the idea of landscape is in this country especially is so tied up with the idea of dominion, because it was part of the idea of dominion that allowed us to claim lands which were not necessarily ours if we were the ones claiming it. And in one of your stories, Lauren, one of the characters is imagining what an early Quaker explorer would have made of Florida, and she thinks a damp, dense tangle, an Eden of dangerous things. And similarly, in the Mars Room, one of the inmates who knows Romy, the main character, is from a place called Apple Valley, and this inmate says, "Oh, it feels so good to have a place to put your anger, to punish someone like you've been hurt." And I want to ask a question that, since women are at the heart of both of your books, I wonder if both of you could talk about the ways that women are the site of and resist punishment, and suffer from and resist what is being exercised there?
Women as a, oh gosh, what do I say about that? I'm distracted by Apple Valley, which is a real place in San Bernardino County. I actually was just there recently because a friend of mine who's serving a life sentence in a women's prison in California and is a transgender man wanted me to go and find his mother, who lives off the grid in Apple Valley. And they hadn't spoken in 20 years. Should I just tell you this story really quickly? Because I don't know how to answer the question. Requires a sort of ability to reduce and make kind of, cone-like statements that I feel unable to produce right now. I just got back from France yesterday. So I went to Apple Valley to find this woman who had stopped contacting her daughter 20 years ago. And I was thinking about my friend. And the reason that I agreed to go is because, first, who else is going to do this for this person who has absolutely no support on the outside, was convicted for a gang killing, never snitched on the other people who were involved in it, was not supported by the gang at all once she went into prison, which is very, very, I'm not saying that that should happen, but this is also tells you about a gender dynamic with people who come from the so-called problematic layer of society that will, you know, from which the prison populations are pulled. If men go to prison and have done honorably by their gang, they are supported while they're inside. People put money on their books. People help them out in various ways. Women get no support whatsoever from the gang, and then later on, they don't get support from their families, and the visiting rooms in women's prisons are not crowded on the weekends. And in California, when they were in their prison building frenzy between 1980 and about 2012, when a new prison was sited in a small town in the Central Valley, which is where they're all pretty much sited, is where we grow food for the country. If a men's prison was going to be built, the local communities, primarily Republicans, live in Central Valley, people would come out and protest, and a lot of what they were concerned about was this sort of unsavory population that would be coming to visit their family on the weekends. And when women's prisons were built in small towns, no one was concerned about who was coming because nobody was coming. So to come back around to my friend in prison, this person has no support on the outside, and I thought, well, I'll go to visit the mother because I'm the only person willing to do it. And also, I thought, I know what I want to say to this person's mother about what her daughter, as I put it, I wasn't going to hit her with a lot of different kinds of news at one time. I like to meet people where they're at, is how I put it. I wanted to let her know that her daughter is someone I met through human rights work that I do, and somebody I admire and had learned from. And I thought about this for almost a year in preparation mentally to go speak to this woman. But what I hadn't understood was what the impact would be on this woman who had learned to live without a daughter, who was serving a life sentence, and frankly, had decided to forget about her and had formed her life without her. And I was suddenly confronted with her trauma in the situation and what prison does to families. And I hadn't considered her feelings, so it was a deeply humbling moment for me. So that took place in Apple Valley and does kind of give an idea of a certain kind of gender dynamic. I mean, maybe I could say one reductive thing that I think has been true from my observations and my friendships with people in prison and what I've seen in men's prison as well. At least in California, which I think is a kind of bellwether and a symbol in a way of larger structures in America, especially in the criminal justice system, the men are treated like monsters and the women are treated like babies. And in a way, I'd rather be a monster than a baby, but I would prefer to be neither.
I think you just demonstrated the the capacity for your storytelling to hold immense amounts of complexity in it, rather than reduce it.
For better or worse.
No, there's a line in your book that goes something like, people were a lot stupider than you thought, but that wasn't bad because they were also a lot less demonic. And I think one of the things that this book does, and yours as well, Lauren, rejects a reduction of a very complex field to a series of signs. Mm. And one of the ways, Lauren, that you've done it throughout your work and also in this book is there are elements of mythology in the seagull, in your symbology that you use throughout the book. And I wonder if you can talk about myth as a way to hold complexity, because it clearly is something that you have read a lot of and understand very well. And one of the joys of reading your book is feeling those old myths come back to life, but in new form.
Mm. Well, I do think that this is our job as literary writers, right? Is to not reduce things; it's to make them more complex. Almost by the end of a book or a story, you should see a fragmentation of what you believed. This is my belief of what the job of a literary writer is. It's to ask more questions than we thought possible at the beginning of the book. But I love mythology because I'm a huge fan of Bruno Bettelheim and Marina Warner and people who have worked very deeply in this realm. And I love how mythology changes depending on the person or the group or the time in which it's being rewritten. And I find that really kind of moving and beautiful. And the Baba Yaga, for instance, of 2018 is not the Baba Yaga of 1950 or 1850 Russia, right? She's changed. She's become something different. And in this way, I think that we can actually be really subversive when it comes to archetypes, because archetypes are not static, right? Archetypes are not things that are only repeating the things that we already know. I think archetypes can be used in order to expand the limits of what we have believed in the past. So I use mythology as sort of almost a variation in themes, almost in a musical way. I wish I were more musical than I am, but my music comes through writing. In order to take an idea and to play with it, throughout all of my books, almost as like it's a theme that I come back to again
like a score.
And again. A score, right? It's a musical score, and I don't think of my books as discrete objects. I think of them as speaking to each other, and hopefully destroying what I've done before. That's what I really want to do with each successive book. I want to just obliterate what I've done before.
There will be no book burning after this.
No.
Rachel, as Lauren was speaking, I was thinking one of the archetypes that emerges in your book. Is the family. Romy grows up sort of with a not neglectful but not present mother and a missing father, and goes to prison and sort of makes a family out of the people that are there. And I wonder if you can talk a bit about some of the characters that she meets and the ways that they play into or don't the nuclear family.
Sure, yeah. Well, the character Romy, when she talks about her background, as I had mentioned before, she is from my neighborhood in San Francisco, and I would not, I think, have been able to inhabit her voice, especially in the first person, and have the depth and the range of understanding that I needed if I hadn't made her a girl I could know intimately because she was in my friend group and from my street and from my world. And in a certain sense, she's a kind of homage to a lot of the women that I grew up with whose destinies, I should say, I mean, obviously, were quite different than my own, most of the people with whom I grew up. And I didn't really want to burden her with an absent father and a neglectful mother in order to explain what happens to her. And I think that's important for me because the role of psychology and character in fiction is not necessarily my primary interest at all. It was more that she spoke in a tone and with a kind of refusal to sentimentalize, and then some of her background rolled out, and it was from a type of background that, as I said, was very familiar to me from growing up, from the other kids I grew up with. Nobody really had a stable background and two parents. When I started working, totally separate from my novel, I started doing human rights work in the main women's prison in California, which is known as Chowchilla. It's the largest women's prison in the world. There's almost 4,000 women there. And one of the things that did strike me about the place, without wanting to sound sentimental myself, was the types of communities that people had built. It's also a really brutal and cruel place. And women, like, instead of shanking each other in the hallway, like the men do, can really terrorize one another psychologically. But there are also examples of support among people. And the work that I did was with a group called Justice Now that teaches human rights law to women in prison. And so it was a kind of model of empathy among women in prison. And the more I got to know those people, the more I learned about their lives in prison, something really struck me, which was the collective nature of intelligence in prison and the methods that women had built to look out for one another. They were never one person's sort of like Martin Luther King idea of this is how we're going to do things. They always seemed to have been sort of organically accreted from the population, which is always shifting. There are a lot of lifers in prison, but a lot of people are coming and going. It was something about a collective resistance to the authority of the prison and its protean nature, because the population is shifting and the rules are always changing, because the structure, the guards are not stupid. I mean, the California system is always trying to outsmart the methods that people develop for getting around the rules and the laws. And it was this collective intelligence really that struck me.
One of the really memorable scenes is when they go to the prison for the first time and they get a rule book that's 40 pages. One character says to the other, "Is there a rule book for the rule book?"
Right.
And a lot of the stories they tell each other are all about sort of wily stories about getting out of an impossible situation or something sort of absurd. And I wonder if you can read a little bit from the novel, from the cement mixer passage.
Sure. Yeah, actually, I base this on a Texas protocol rather than California. In Texas, they have a rule book for prisoners that's 140 pages, and then they have a guide to the rule book for prisoners, which is like 63 pages. So it's the rule book and the guide that the correctional officer hands out, and then the character Conan says, "Is there a guide to the rule book?" And, gets his first write-up. And he's just arrived in prison that day. This is just people talking in the prison, Romy and her friend Sammy, and Conan, who is, if anyone's confused, is a trans man in the women's prison. Sammy told us she'd owned a Trans Am at age 15. Her dealer and boyfriend, Smokey, had given it to her. "I know a Smokey," Conan said. "It ain't Smokey from Bell Gardens you're talking about, is it?" "It was," Sammy said. "Smokey was your boyfriend? I'm from Bell Gardens, and the Smokey I know is a she." I didn't know that when I met him," Sammy said. "This fine-ass guy wearing, what are they called, those little white shells around his neck, shows up, and we're partying. He's got a bottle of PCP. And the next thing I know, I'm in a motel in Whittier, and it's 2 days later." "Puka shells," Sergeant McKinley said over the PA. "He was in the program office behind one-way glass, listening to our conversation with long-range microphones. I wake up with no memory of how I got there. I'm covered in hickeys, and this person, Smokey, is sleeping next to me. We're both like, we don't have our clothes on. I peek under the sheet, and he was the same as me down there. I was shocked. We were together for 2 years after that. Smokey could hotwire any vehicle. She would steal a car, we'd party in it, wipe off the prints, and dump it. Once they were in a fight, and Sammy was trying to buy heroin at the hamburger stand in Compton, Smokey came revving up in this horribly loud cement truck, the mixer on the back revolving full tilt. Sammy yelled over the grinding noise for Smokey to shut it off. I could not score with a cement mixer next to me. So I start walking away to lose her and that noisy thing, and Smokey's driving it the speed of my walking. No dealer was going to sell to me creating a scene like that. I'm yelling, turn it off, the what's it called, the spinning thing. And she's going, I don't know how. All she could do was put it in gear and drive it. We were yelling at each other, and finally I got in so we could fight in private. We go driving around in this cement mixer, and we're starting to get along. I'm not mad anymore. The driver had left his lunchbox on the seat. I opened it thinking I'd drink his juice, eat his sandwich, whatever he had in there, and inside the lunchbox is the dude's wallet. Smokey and I got in a fight all over again. She had this crack idea that because she hotwired the cement mixer, the wallet was hers. Nuh-uh, sorry. I took the cash and got out. Our relationship had a lot of drama to it like that. Different ideas on things.
I'm going to ask a final question of Lauren, and then I'd open up to questions from the everyone here. I think there might be a microphone floating around, but when we were backstage, we were talking about cars, and Lauren is from the East Coast, and we're from the West Coast, and so we had our own separate conversation, but we kind of met in the middle by talking about Graceland, which the two of them have been to multiple times. And I wonder, you know, I would have definitely pegged Rachel Kushner as a Graceland visitor, but you, I'm more surprised about. And I wonder if you can talk about sort of your engagement with deep fried America and all its muchness, and what comes into your fiction, and how, you know, how you, I don't know, police or do not police that barrier.
Oh, well, first of all, Graceland's amazing, and it's not because of Graceland itself, it's because of the people who go to Graceland, right? I have taken pictures of the people there and not of Graceland itself. I actually don't even know what Graceland has in it. But I love Americana. I love Florida, especially Florida Americana. There's this place that I have to take you to if you ever come to Gainesville, both of you, and all of you. It's called Bob's River Place. It's on the Suwannee River, and it's a place where a man just opened up his property and put a bunch of really high rope swings into the Suwannee River, which is infested with alligators. And he charges $10 per head, and people, like, every single weekend someone breaks their neck there. But it's the most amazing place to go and people watch. I have never seen anything like that. I always take my guests there because that's the real Florida. So deep fried Florida, deep fried Americana, I could not care about cars. I don't even know what a car is. I barely drive. But I do care about the people. The people are so interesting. And so whatever, you know, they're passionate about, I'd like to get to listen to, because it's actually not talking about the thing itself. It's talking about who they are as people and their souls and their values and their moral systems. And that's what's interesting to me.
Mm. Well, in some ways, both of these books are books about what happens to the soul in situations. And we haven't been able to get to it, but I do feel like both of your books are asking deeply spiritual questions about what life is like, you know, in a world without God. And I feel like in both of their cases, it's not the Flannery O'Connor, God's mad at you. It's like the Joy Williams, God has forgotten about you world of that question. So I'm just going to kind of leave that on the table because I think it's time to open it up to the audience for questions from you. There's microphones in the back.
Can I say one quick thing, though?
Yeah.
Just before he reached the Holy Land, Elvis performed in Eugene, Oregon. Was anybody there? I was there. It's true. He stayed at the Valley River Center Hotel.
Anyone have a question? There's
right,
one up,
right
in,
up
there's
here.
There's one up in the front up here.
This question is directed to Rachel. Loved your book, The Mars Room. Just read it in our book club. And we had quite a discussion about your decision to include Ted Kaczynski as kind of a thread throughout the novel. Could you talk a little bit about that decision and your notions of how it was to incorporate into the story?
Sure, yeah. No, it's a great question. There's a character in the book, for those who haven't read it, that named Gordon, who's a teacher in the women's prison, and he's a kind of failed graduate student who had wanted to write about Thoreau and American transcendentalism, which also interests me greatly. Then he is given as a kind of joke by a friend, a Ted Kaczynski reader, which does not exist in real life. And then he's reading, interspersed in the book, are five passages from the diaries of Ted Kaczynski, which do exist in real life. However, they are not printed anywhere. They are owned by an artist I know who was given them by somebody else who purchased them at the FBI auction, the proceeds of which, I should say, went to the victims and the victims' families of Ted Kaczynski. And I started reading those journals and was really interested in the strength of the voice. I don't mean a moral strength, but just the cadence. And I transcribed some of them and realized this is so different than my own voice. If I tried to approximate what these are in fiction, I could never pull it off. And so I was interested in how different they were, and also in the progression in the diaries. In the early days of his diaries, they mostly describe his efforts to live alone in nature, and he was reading Walden and interested in solitude and self-reliance, and also the technological destruction of the world, which we know interested Thoreau a great deal. But quite quickly, his misanthropy becomes much stronger than Thoreau's, and which is not to overstress the comparison between the two, but it did engender for me certain thoughts about whether or not nature is a solution to the problem of people. For Ted, he attempts to make nature a solution to that problem, but people encroach and enrage him. He hears the sound of snowmobiles, so he does exactly what you would do, which is he breaks into the snowmobiler's cabin, trashes all their stuff, sets their snowmobiles on fire, and pours out all their bottles of vodka. So I was interested in that progression, and then after I wrote the book, I began to think of those passages of Kaczynski in a way like archival documents from the real world that made their way into my book untransformed, almost like photographs. And the challenge with the text was to flow around them like rocks. So that's, I guess, my answer.
Any final questions? Oh, there's one in the back waving.
Of the women who killed their abuser.
The question is, have you ever dealt with any women who have killed their abuser? Is that the question? Or husbands?
Well, I have a good friend who, well, let me think about that. In different ways, yes. I mean, first I should say, every woman, pretty much, that I've ever met who is serving a long sentence in prison has been abused. So whether or not she killed her actual abuser or someone else almost becomes irrelevant. But maybe that's to say I'm not so interested in the axis of guilt versus innocence. And a woman who's killed her abuser may seem more relatively innocent than the woman who has killed somebody who was not her abuser. There are many women who have killed men who've done harm to them or someone else who's done harm to them. But everyone in prison has had a hell of a lot of harm done to them. And that's the thing that I'm more interested in thinking about.
I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. Rachel Kushner and Lauren Groff, it's been a pleasure. They will be signing books after. Please join them.
That was a conversation between Lauren Groff and Rachel Kushner at the Portland Book Festival in November 2018. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project, a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for the Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear more from the Archive Project, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Support for the Archive Project comes from Cole Haan, the fashion brand that aims to inspire and empower people to live an extraordinary life. All this and more at colehaan.com. Our show is produced by Crystal Liguori for radio and podcast. Special thanks to the literary arts staff, board, and community. This show would not be possible without them. Thanks also to the band Emancipator for our theme music, and thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another edition of the Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.